You are not just your egg count. When it comes to fertility, there is so much more going on, even if you have low ovarian reserve. Today, we interview Dr. Mark Sklar, a natural fertility specialist, and we talk about eggs, what is at the root of low ovarian reserve, and what to do about it. Dr. Mark shares what he wishes for the world of fertility, and he shares his incredible wisdom. You do not want to miss this one. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes. We are so excited to have Dr. Mark Sklar on the podcast today. Dr. Mark, aka the fertility expert, is a natural fertility specialist helping couples get pregnant for 20 years. His mission is to help you feel hopeful and confident about your fertility journey again. In addition to his doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine, Dr. Sklar trained at the Harvard Medical School, Mind-Body Medical Institute. He is the creator of Fertility TV, MarkSklar.com, and ReproductiveWellness.com, and the co-author of Secret to Conception and a fellow of the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine and medical advisor for Natural Health International. As well as his online program, he also supports his community via his highly popular YouTube channel, Fertility TV, where he shares information-packed videos to educate his followers on all things fertility. The fertility expert lives in San Diego with his wife and two sons, where he has his two clinics. But he also works with couples all over the world through his fertility online coaching. Thank you so much for being here, Mark. We're so excited.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled and excited to be here. And, you know, I love this conversation. I think we're going to have a lot of good information to share with everyone today.
Good. I'm so excited. So let's just dive right in. For anyone who doesn't know, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, how you support people in the fertility space?
Yeah. So I've been practicing for 20 years, all pretty much in the field of fertility and reproductive health. And I support couples in multiple ways. But here in San Diego, I've got my, practice, between four walls, essentially, where we see couples locally. And then I support couples all over the world through my online coaching program. And I've been doing that for close to 8 years. And, you know, aside from that, I'm always looking to be able to give and support couples who are going through fertility issues and just trying to educate them. So I do a lot of that through my social media platforms and Instagram and YouTube. I think my passion, more importantly, when we talk about this, is really to empower couples with knowledge so that they can make the best and most informed decision for themselves, whatever path that they choose. And I find that so many couples are really just misinformed or uninformed when it comes to fertility. And so they end up moving forward with certain decisions or treatments or paths more out of fear and loss of hope, and really just like they're rudderless. And so someone says, let's go do this. And so that's what they do, versus making those decisions because it's the right, a sound decision for them based on their situation, their history, and the path or choices in front of them. So I really just want couples to be able to make the right decision for themselves and not feel like they don't have any other options available.
I love that. And my story, and anyone who's listened, that my husband and I had to do IVF, we actually came to you as well. And there's a time and a place for these treatments and support. And it is just looking at each individual case and figuring out what is the best path forward. And sometimes it isn't necessarily what is being recommended with their current doctor. And sometimes it is. And so I love that you're all about empowering and giving people the option to choose, because at the end of the day, the paths to parenthood are many. And as long as people are kind of going down that path feeling empowered, that's awesome. So thank you for doing the work you do in the world.
I think that it's really interesting too, just as a general theme of kind of all the things we talk about on this podcast, how there is this sort of cultural paradigm shift that hasn't happened in many realms, but is sort of currently happening. And we're all, as practitioners, we're really trying to make this change so that people have these sort of like, I think about it like a pyramid, and it's like this base level information that they can then work from and make decisions on top of that, right? Like if there's a reason why fertility is not being achieved, let's rule out all these other things before directly going to IUI, IVF, et cetera. It's just that the current medical system and the model, like when they are being pushed into these different other specialists, that's kind of the way that they work. And I understand that. That's the way that their training was. And they're really good at doing that when people really need it. It's just that we want to capture all of the people who don't really need all of that and don't need to go all through all of the medications and the stress, the money, the hormones, et cetera, when it may be some sort of another fix that actually optimizes their health for them as a person moving forward so that they actually live a healthier life too. It's like, it's so much more than just producing a baby. It's a lot more, I think, for us. We find such passion in that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I chuckle because, you know, I 100% agree with everything you just said, but that's just not the impression that they're given, right? Or the thought. And, you know, I don't want the listeners to get a misunderstanding about IVF. Like, I'm a proponent of it. I think there's a place for it. 50% of the couples that we support use IUI or IVF, and there's absolutely a need for it. My issue is that IVF, when it was originally created, and I know things evolve, but when it was originally created, was not intended to be used in the way that it's being used today.
100%.
In the frequency that it is. And so one part of that I think is a beautiful thing is because, you know, how much it's being used today is because of the acceptance of fertility as a mainstream issue to discuss and talk about. And so as fertility, you know, fertility conversations used to be so taboo, and now everyone's much more open, thank God, with discussing them. But as a result of that, that means marketing is much more in your face about what you need to support your fertility. And as a result, all these couples who might be trying for 3 months or 6 months, when they go to their OB or even just at home, or they're talking to their friends and they're saying, oh, I'm struggling to get pregnant, the answer invariably that they're told is you need IVF. And I personally feel like upwards of 60 to 80% of couples who go through IVF are going to IVF prematurely, and that they should be doing things initially to address the root issues, to support their overall health and reproductive function and hormones, and then give themselves some time to conceive. And then if at that point they're not successful, then there's the place for IVF. Now, there's exceptions to all of that, but in general, I think that's my biggest frustration today is that on the one side, it's great that we're talking about it more. On the flip side, that just means, you know, IVF is being used much more and much earlier than it was ever intended to.
Yeah, no, we completely agree, and beautifully said. So with that, you know, we've talked about a lot of different topics on this podcast, but I think one of the things that you focus on a lot is lower ovarian reserve, so lower egg count, and kind of how that plays into the fertility conversation, because that's not the only reason for infertility. However, it is a big part of it for many couples. So can you kind of speak to that in the sense of kind of what you see in the lower ovarian reserve community, whether that's advanced age or premature ovarian insufficiency? And I know these are a lot of big words that we're kind of throwing out, but for anyone listening, basically a woman has eggs that mature to become one dominant egg in a natural or unassisted fertility situation, or many of those eggs or follicles will mature to become eggs in IVF. And if you don't have many of them, if you have a low count or a low reserve, then it can be one big obstacle for fertility. So can you kind of speak to that and that kind of what you see and what you do and support people with in that?
Yeah, absolutely. So where I like to start in this conversation is I like to let listeners know that not all fertility issues are egg quality or egg reserve issues. Because invariably, you might see the same thing when you're working with couples, but invariably, I start working with somebody and they're taking a whole slew of supplements. When I ask them why or who prescribed it, like, well, I found this all online, I was doing my research, and you know, and I mean, I could see what they are, so I know why they're taking them, but I always like to get that, you know, question when I ask them. that answer when I ask them, because invariably their answer is always, well, I'm taking this for egg quality. You know, I want to improve my egg quality. And there's nothing wrong with improving egg quality, but not all fertility issues are egg quality or ovarian reserve related. And I think there's a big disconnect between that, right? Someone is having difficulties getting pregnant. All the information they receive and hear about is all about egg quality. So that's where they end up going in terms of, oh, that's what's wrong with me. I just need some egg quality support. So I like to kind of put that out in the open up front, because I would say probably 40%+ of the couples we work with, when we look at their history and their lab work, there's no egg quality issue. There's no ovarian reserve issue, but that's what they're taking supplements for, and kind of that's their whole focus. And so I think it's really important that regardless of what the what the main diagnosis you've been given, is that we still need to treat each person individually as an individual human being with their own constitution and makeup. And so with that means that we need to dive deeper to understand why these things are happening.
Yeah. Really quick, before you go into more of the ovarian reserve, just because I think maybe this will be other questions on listeners' minds. What, in your opinion, if you were to break down the percentages, what percentage goes to, an ovarian issue, a sperm issue, a ovulation issue just in general, or whatever, how would you break it down based on your population of patients that you see as kind of like the most common reasons why the fertility isn't being met?
So I'm actually going to start in a place where this, when we're talking about percentages, which is what this specific segment is not on, but male fertility. So male fertility for me makes up anywhere between 40 to 50% of the issue. Now, sometimes that's a combined issue, male, female factors, but that is a huge variable that 100% needs to be addressed, and needs to be addressed more and more and more, not less and less, which is really what I'm saying. There's like so many clinics are just downplaying that role. And the reason they're downplaying it is because, oh, you're just going to do IVF. So who cares? We just need one good one or whatever, you know, the amount is to match the sperm, to match the eggs. But the reality is none of these couples, none of you listening, want to do IVF if you didn't have to. So let's improve that sperm quality and give you a fair chance at home to conceive naturally. So that's a huge one. Stress is a huge, huge variable. I mean, that number, because it's usually a cofactor with other conditions, that number is easily 80, 90% when I see it. Yeah, it's super high. Just this morning, I read an email from a member of my program who was telling me how she was doing, but all her issues that, you know, she had some positive changes, but all the issues that she was having were because of stress. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as she backed off, those things went away. And so it's just another example as to how impactful that really is into the bigger picture when we're talking about fertility. I know people are tired of hearing about stress, but I can't ignore it because it's a huge, huge variable. Other conditions, PCOS is huge. I would say about 20-25%. Egg quality issues are there, I would say, in populations of women who are 40 and older. That egg quality issue is relatively high in some comparison, in some way. But I think coming back to the previous question, I think this is a great place to talk about it, because your FSH and your AMH really, really, really only matter in terms of your true ability to conceive if you are going to do IVF.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Those numbers, the research shows and came out very early this year or very late last year. I can't remember the exact date of the article that was published, but it showed that your FSH and AMH markers are not good predictors of your ability to conceive and have a child. And what they were specifically talking about is as it relates to natural conception. I mean, those are important numbers when someone's trying to create a protocol and utilize medication to stimulate your ovaries and get eggs and create embryos. Those do have a purpose there. But if you're just trying at home, and I see this over and over, those numbers, I'm not saying that we shouldn't check them, I'm saying they shouldn't hold the same value and importance as everyone is putting on them. And the reason those are given that value is because we talk about it so much for fertility treatments, for IVF. And so everybody gets all concerned when their AMH is low or their FSH is high. For me, those are just numbers that give us more information that tell you, okay, well, we just need to support those things. We need to find out why they are where they are at and then do something about it. And I think that's really the biggest disconnect that I see when it comes to this information. So I had a woman who I've been working with for a little over a year. I think let's just say like a year and 3 months. And she started, and for the first 6 months, I did nothing having to do with supporting her AMH or FSH levels. Absolutely nothing. All I did was support her gut because she had so many gut issues. When we retested her numbers, her FSH dropped beautifully. Her AMH increased dramatically. And so her AMH over a year ago was like 2.3, I think it was. Okay. And it was beautiful. She's feeling 90% better. She's doing great, but she's not getting pregnant and she's getting frustrated. And I understand. And she's just trying and trying and trying. The next time we checked her levels was about 3 months ago. And she's like, I've been trying for so long. Naturally, it's just not working. I think I'm ready to do IVF. And in situations like that, I don't deter anybody. You've been trying for a while. I get it. She's put in a lot of work even before I saw her. So going to IVF makes a lot of sense, or is something that should be explored. And she was, you know, tired of the time and her patients had run thin, which I totally understand. But when we tested her AMH dropped dramatically. And I can't even explain why. I have no clue, because she's so much healthier than she was. But it was like 0.5 or 0.4. Like, that's a big swing in a year, especially for someone who was doing all the right things. So her question to me was, well, what should I do? I'm like, I'm looking at what she's doing. I'm like, I don't want you to change anything. I mean, you're doing great, and I'm not worried about your AMH right now, even though it's not an ideal number, and I'm not discounting that. It's just not something that I'm going to focus on, because everything else you're doing is great, and you're feeling good, more importantly. So she sets up her appointment to go to the IVF clinic for August, for next month. A week ago or 2 weeks ago, she posts that she has a positive pregnancy test. Yay! And her numbers look beautiful. So I say this for a couple of reasons. One is, clearly the AMH didn't matter, okay? Because if it did, she would have gotten pregnant when it was 2.3, not when she was 0.5 or 0.4. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in situations like this, there's nothing more to do than just give it some time and try. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the hardest thing that we ask anybody to do, is you're doing great, everything's going well, you just got to give it a little bit more time, right? And that's hard when you have somebody who's been trying for years and years and years. So I use this example really more to highlight that AMH is a number that we need to look at. Ovarian reserve obviously is important, but it's not the end of the world. And your fertility is not your AMH. It's much more than that. And one value in and of itself is not the whole picture when it comes to your fertility. Just like a painting is not one brushstroke or one pixel on a screen or on a canvas, it's the entire thing. So I think it's really important that often we take a step back and just look at the whole picture to understand what's going on. Obviously, age is an issue, right? As we age, yes, it's a concern. Our ovarian reserve theoretically goes down. I'm a believer, though, that we can enhance and support and improve our ovarian reserve with the right support and the right nourishment, that we've been taught all of this, that our, you know, we don't produce any more eggs, they only go down, and we don't create more. I don't think that information is 100% accurate, and there's more research coming out every day that actually shows that that's not necessarily true if we can actually give our ovarian cells the nutrients that they deserve. So age is obviously an issue, but I also think our lifestyle. I have 45-year-olds that we're working with, and when you look at their hormones, their AMH and FSH look like they were 32, you know, or 35. And so there's ways to get there. There's ways to do that. And I think those of us who, you know, take care of ourselves, treat the underlying issues, are ahead of the game in terms of our ability to achieve that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's so amazing. You're so inspiring to me. And so my question with that is, because the numbers themselves don't necessarily matter, in somebody who is younger, let's say in their late 20s, early to mid 30s, that does test with a low AMH or has done, let's say, an antral follicle count on ultrasound and they have a low amount of follicles, do you then see that as just a symptom of some other underlying imbalance? Or is there ever a time where you're like, this is a condition? Because in the conventional model, they're just like, oh, you have premature ovarian failure or insufficiency, go to IVF, versus, you know, what do you see? What flags go off in your mind when you see that? And as a follow-up to that, do you see any specific or repeat kind of underlying factors in those patterns, you know?
Whether it be like gut health, as you mentioned.
Or toxins or something.
Right. Something where you're like, oh, if I see this pattern, there's usually also this pattern going on.
Yeah. So I think the one thing I want to highlight, and I wanted to mention it before, but this is a great place to add it in, is I think we lose sight of the fact, and you mentioned it earlier when you were, I think, defining something, Leah, is in a normal menstrual cycle and normal ovulation, a woman matures one healthy follicle and egg. One. We don't need 20. We need one. And even if you had 20, it's really only should be producing and maturing one healthy one. So I want everyone to not lose sight of the fact that truly all we need is one good egg every cycle. That's it. Whether your antral follicle count is 3 or 20, whether your AMH is 2.5 or 0.4, we only need one healthy egg and one healthy sperm to create an embryo. And so I don't want that to be lost in the conversation. And I think that keeps things, if we think about that, I think that can keep our feet on the ground when we're going through all of this. Now with that, that means we do need to have a healthy menstrual cycle. We need to be ovulating regularly. So all of those things need to be part of that process. But regardless of our age, all we need is one healthy egg. So to that point, and to your question about POI, is I always start when I see something like that is saying, well, this 30-year-old, this 25-year-old should not be in this position. This is not a normal circumstance unless there's some sort of genetic issue that's at play. So why is the, and that's not typical. So why is this happening? And so for me, I still want to find the root issue as to why that's happening and address that to hopefully restore proper healthy function. That's not always possible. Like, you know, I can't say that we get 100% success when it comes to that, but that's the goal up front. And I do historically think that there is that that's possible, that we can do that. But also with the understanding from that individual that we still only need one good healthy egg. So I still go back to focusing on regular menstruation, regular ovulation, making sure the healthy sperm are there so that we can give them as good of a chance every cycle. With that being said, of course, we see things that are at the root of that more often than not. I would say stress and trauma, which I'll put into one category, are definitely up on that list. You know, we talked about stress earlier, and that is going to impact their endocrine system, the way their pituitary and hypothalamus function properly. And so that's the first thing I want to rule out or rule in and understand better. And so I'm usually asking about traumatic issues and, you know, other stressful circumstances. And some of these things are things that we don't even think about as being, you know, major stressful events, but the way their individual body processed it absolutely was. So I think that's a huge variable. I think we can't talk about this in our current world that we live in without discussing toxins. I mean, environmental toxins are huge, and the issues that I'm seeing with that are not decreasing, they're only increasing. So much so that actually part of my standard workup now is going to shift to include, testing for environmental toxins, just because of how much I'm finding and the levels that I'm seeing. And that's a huge, huge problem that that I see all the time. Now, if someone comes and says, since the age of 10, I've always had digestive issues, that definitely can't be ignored. For me, the crux of all health issues always goes back to digestion and a healthy gut function. And so I historically, focus so much on that. Maybe part of that is because I've always had digestive issues personally. So it's a big thing that I can't ignore. But those are the big things. I also think that crucial time for women who are teenagers when they're in puberty and they're developing, they're going through a lot, they're maybe highly active physically. These are just, it's like a little science experiment in a beaker that's ready to explode. And so, that crucial time, I always want to get a little bit more information on in that population specifically, like what happened during this time and how were your hormones and how was your menstrual cycle and what was going on. I mean, I just had a woman who, her mom, because she was an oops baby when her mom was a teenager, her mom didn't want the same thing to happen to her. And so even though she wasn't sexually active, her mom put her not just on birth control since she was like 11, put her on Depo.
Oh no.
Wow.
Since she was 11 till like 18 or 20, something like that.
Right.
And she's created this, for lack of a better word, hormonal storm. It's just chaos. Mm-hmm. And now we have to clean that up, and that's going to take some time. That's not an easy, quick fix. So that time frame is a really crucial time frame as well.
So given that, I'm going to ask you a controversial question in that, do you believe or see in your patients that were put on birth control maybe earlier in their teenage years, or maybe in general in their teenage years or for long periods of time, do you see that playing a role in even just, coincidental kind of findings where you're like, wow, a lot of my patients that had that, or are you like, no, it doesn't seem to matter?
It definitely matters. I see it pretty regularly. Now, there are some individuals that surprise me. So there are exceptions to that rule. Someone who's been on birth control for a long time and they don't have any issues. I think just constitutionally, they were stronger. Their body was more prepared and able to handle it. But in general, I think it's a huge issue that we're seeing. And I don't see it going away anytime soon. Now that we've gotten over-the-counter birth control.
I know.
Yeah. Oh my God. I understand the point of it, but that's not going to help this situation in any way.
Right. It just needs to go back to the informed consent, where it's not like a conspiracy theory to say that, hey, you can take this if you want to prevent pregnancy. Totally valid and understand that. Also, just know that there may come a time when you do want to get pregnant if you choose that, or after you get off it, where there's going to be hormone issues, because this is a known fact. And let's not act like it's not. The person can still choose if they want to do that. That's absolutely up to them. But it's just so silly that we seem like we're not allowed to say that in the conventional model, or they don't want to recognize it. Maybe they don't believe it. I don't know what it is, but
yeah,
with people like you too, who are doing this day in and day out, and you see it, it's like right before your eyes. You can't possibly deny it. And I think something that we want, all three of us as practitioners, is for people to be, like you said in the very beginning of the podcast, feeling like you have all the information so you can make the best choice that you want to make, because a lot of people will still continue to make that choice. And I think that's awesome. Do what you want to do, but know so that at the back end, you're not going, oh my gosh, I wish I had known. And I wish I had known, and I would have done something different. And now here I am, regretting this decision, or having to go through all these things, or maybe never getting the child that I want. Like, what a sad situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the hard thing with that is, having a teenager myself, even though he's a boy, I don't know that they can properly make that decision for themselves, right? At least they're informed But I don't know that they have the wherewithal to make that decision. I would hope that the parents have a better understanding and can educate them a little bit better. Now, it's hard to tell a teenager whose hormones are raising, like, just put on a condom. You know, so I get it. And, you know, I understand that. I think if we're going to use birth control, that we need to, or the birth control pill, I should say, that we need to be informed as much as we can. And we need to come off of it as soon as possible. Like, you know, let's take it for as little time as possible. If you're out of a relationship, let's take a little break. It's okay to ask the man in the relationship to take some responsibility as well. When it comes to birth control, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's my preferred way in that whole process. But that's hard for teenagers. So I get it.
Yeah, totally. Okay, controversial question number two.
Love it.
there are some studies and some kind of, you know, chatter and stuff about a lot of women potentially having premature ovarian insufficiency due to the Gardasil vaccine. And I know it's very controversial in the conventional world, but what would you say to that? Are you like, I think there's maybe some truth in that or not? Because I know I hosted an IVF support group a couple years ago during COVID, and it was just that had come to my attention based on one of the girls, and I kind of looked into it, and I hadn't known that. And I did a poll of all the women who had lower egg reserve, and the ones that did, almost all of them had the Gardasil vaccine, and the ones that didn't hadn't. And it was not like a study or anything, but I was like, that's very interesting to me. And I'm just curious. I want to ask more practitioners what your thoughts are.
I'm not a fan of the vaccine at all. I think there's a lot of issues. I understand why it's being recommended. I think we could probably do that a little bit more judiciously and understand someone's history, or take other precautions. Yeah, I'm not a fan of it at all.
Yeah, and for anyone who doesn't know, I guess I didn't explain. The Gardasil vaccine was the vaccine that came out when we were actually like young people for cervical cancer, and it was basically recommended to all women, no matter their age, no matter their sexual activity, to just start taking it. When a lot of the strains that can cause cervical cancer, of HPV and such, are sexually transmitted. So I remember I was offered it at like 12, and I didn't become sexually active till I was 18. And I was like, I don't understand why I need this. And I remember my doctor was like pushing me so hard into it, and I was just like, I don't want this. I don't understand why I need it. But I know so many women didn't know, and they just, you know, were given that. And a lot of them are very sad, you know, again, informed consent. They didn't know. And we didn't know. It was such a new thing at the time. So I think just being cautious in general about new drugs, new things, especially with fertility, we often don't see the repercussions of it for decades.
Right.
You know, because those 12-year-olds aren't going to start having kids for maybe 2 decades. So it's now that we're realizing, oops, that maybe that was a mistake.
And now not now as if it's recent, it's been happening for a while, but we're offering it down to age 9 and boys included. And it's just interesting too, because it's one of the vaccines with the very most known highest adverse reaction rates, really devastating things too. So it's just kind of a funny like paradox that it's continuing to happen, especially with something like a very, very slow growing cancer that's picked up very well on gynecological exams. That's why we do them anyway.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this specific topic because there are conversations on vaccines, but I will say that, you know, one that gets roped into having kids that are of this age and getting vaccines, but I'm highly aware of kind of how to manage those. It's not required for school. You know, and we get into this rhythm of pattern of like, oh, they said I need these things. So yes. And that's how I'm going to get in school. Like there are things you have choices on, and that you can still decide, and make a decision to wait on. It's not essential, to continue their education. And then you might be able to just give yourself some time to do a little bit of research on it. And then maybe even wait to see if they're sexually active. And there are some things that I think your kids are allowed to make decisions on their own when they're 18. And this could be one that you give them that ability to make that decision on versus you having to make that decision for them. So,
yeah, that's really good. So given the conversation, I love everything you've said about you know, treating each person as an individual, understanding their root cause and what's going on. Sometimes low ovarian reserve is a symptom of something else. Given that, though, are there anything in particular, if you do see someone with a lower egg count or something, where you are kind of bringing it into your protocol in general, or are you very much, I only treat the individual, you know, every single person's unique, or are there certain things that you see help improve, you know, egg count at all?
I'm happy to incorporate things more widespread in protocols as long as I know that they also won't do any harm long term, right? So I like incorporating anyone who has low ovarian reserve and wants to improve egg quality as well. And those are not the same thing for everybody listening, right? Two different things. Then I like incorporating light therapy. You know, red light therapy, low light level therapy, because it's benign. It's only going to help. It's not going to hurt anything. So I'm comfortable using that a little bit more. I love incorporating acupuncture in circumstances like this as well for those who I think it's appropriate. I don't think it's, you know, it's not for everybody, but I do think it can be used more widespread than not. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when we start looking at supplements, I think vitamin D is a huge one that everybody can take, and it does help with ovarian reserve in many cases. So there is a correlation between vitamin D and AMH, and so I think that that's one that someone could incorporate. I think incorporating things like CoQ10, again, could be widespread and that everybody can start to incorporate. I'm trying to think if there's some other things that kind of stand out to me. I've started utilizing, but more specifically with older women with lower AMH levels, I've started utilizing NMN mm-hmm. a lot more.
What is that? I don't know what that is.
it's the precursor to NAD.
Mm-hmm. Oh, NAD.
Mm-hmm. NAD, okay. Yeah. And the biggest thing that I see there is that people will take NAD thinking that that's the same thing. It's not the same thing. And I haven't seen research specifically around NAD having the same impact as NMN in this way. Now, it was just a small couple studies, but still something that looked promising. And I don't necessarily think that that's harmful, but the research was actually pretty clear, even though it was small, that showed it was really more impactful specifically in older women with lower AMH levels, not younger women with AMH levels. So I do also make that distinction when I'm incorporating it. But Quick outside question. Of that, I really think that it becomes individualized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When you said the red light therapy, is that specifically mm-hmm. over the abdomen? Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And the sacrum, awesome. Both.
Oh,
you can
nice.
Do both.
Front and back. Oh, I love that.
That is awesome. Cool.
What about DHEA? So, you know, this is, again, we are individualized practitioners, and people a lot of times read it starts with the egg and are on all the things in that book. I've had patients who they are on, you know, DHEA, or they want to take it, but their testosterone and DHEA are actually quite high because they have PCOS. And, you know, obviously people don't always understand what is used for what, but in the research, the DHEA is definitely more indicated for those with lower ovarian reserve. And in my opinion, with low DHEA, I think we should check it. But do you find that helpful at all? Or is it kind of not one that you think much about?
Oh, I something I talk about all the time. Actually just made a video this weekend, and that was one of the things I talked about in it. Mm-hmm. I agree with you 100%. I think DHEA absolutely needs to be tested before someone starts it. One, to find out if you need it at all, and two, to find out what dosage we're going to start at. I think it can be helpful for those who really need it, but I don't think that it's something to just carelessly just take in terms of, because the recommendation is 75 milligrams a day, which is a relatively high dose.
Yeah,
that's really not high. A small dose of DHEA. And it can have really negative impacts for individuals who don't need it or who androgen levels are already elevated. I've had certain circumstances where I've tested it. I thought someone still needed it because their levels were relatively low or lower than I would have liked. And I still start them at a low dose. And it has a negative impact. So I really, when I give it, I still have to watch it very closely and be on top of it that they just might not need it for so long or, you know, we have to manage that dosage in a certain way. So that's one I'm absolutely careful of. I mean, you mentioned it starts with the egg. I know someone who's read the book because the list of supplements they give me is literally everything that she lists in that book. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is, you know, you read, it starts with an egg. Got it. Mm-hmm. and there's, it's useful information, but again, it's not for the masses. It's not, everybody shouldn't be on that entire list of supplements. So I still think that needs to be looked at, individualized, run your labs, understand where the issues are and deficiencies, and then support that. Yeah.
I love that. What about ovarian rejuvenation? I know this is sort of a hot new thing. And what are your thoughts on that? And kind of explain it maybe for our listeners who don't know what it is.
Yeah. So it is exactly what it sounds like, which, and by the way, the light therapy, I think of as ovarian rejuvenation, which is why I like to incorporate it there. But it's trying to rejuvenate the ovarian function and, you know, help produce more eggs and better quality eggs. And it's essentially PRP, just used in the ovaries, platelet-rich plasma. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Stop it. Injected directly into the ovary?
Yep.
Wait a minute. Okay, are we trying to... Okay, hold on. Are we trying to... So this is not my world. I'm in the pregnancy, birth, postpartum world. So all of these like nitty-gritty fertility things, I definitely defer to you experts here. So when we're talking about ovarian rejuvenation, are we trying to function on the level of like then creating new eggs or new follicles in the line of like the thinking of the new research is showing that we actually can do that? Okay. So it's maybe a tapped out ovary and we're going to be like, let's get some new stuff going, like neurogeneration, which, you know, for a long time, they didn't think that like nerves could regrow or that nerves could regenerate. But now it's, we always think we know everything. We just don't.
We don't.
Wow. You can do PRP directly into an ovary. That's amazing. So PRP, for people who don't know, is called plasma-rich protein. They basically draw your blood. They spin it down. They take the plasma, which is full of stem cells and other amazing things, and they can inject it in different places in the body. It's more common in joint spaces or for injury recovery, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a lot that you can do with it. Obviously, this is so cool. I've never heard of this.
Yeah. So they're doing a lot of it now. There are, and it, you know, I know enough about it to say that I like it in certain circumstances and for certain individuals. I think it can definitely be beneficial. It doesn't work for everybody. Even in individuals who I think it should work for, it doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth a try if someone needs that additional support and boost and they have the means to, you know, pay for it. There are most clinics throughout the world only do like a basic PRP protocol. There are probably two or three clinics in the world that have taken it up a notch and have variations of it. One of them happens to be here in San Diego. The others, I think, are in Greece. And Greece is, by the way, was the first clinics to utilize it for fertility were in Greece. Wow. And actually in some countries now, including Greece, but not in the United States, they are doing stem cell.
I was just going to ask about
as well for this exact thing, and we're starting to see a little bit of information and research on it, but it's still relatively new. It does look promising, I will say, and I have had a couple of women that I'm working with whose ovaries, you know, they're much older, and whose ovaries really just aren't functioning in the way we'd ideally like to see for fertility, and they've tried it, and now I'm just waiting to kind of see how those results are for those individuals. But it's super cool. I think there's a lot of promise and optimism around it. But again, I would say, you know, it's not going to work for 100% of the individuals. So it doesn't mean we don't try it. It just means that, you know, we can't always expect miracles. But I think it could be really beneficial, especially with an overall plan that we're doing all the other things to support somebody, that, you know, this can be a nice added thing to put in.
Can you do it to for sperm regeneration as well, or for sperm numbers?
I have not seen that at all.
I don't know. It's a good question. So
it's a great question, but I have not seen it. I think the place where we'd probably would want to kind of test it out would be those men who are azoospermic, and it's not, yeah, and it's not, and it's not from a blockage,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right. There's no structural issue as well, so I think that might be a place where we'd want to potentially try it, but I don't see men running.
Sounds really, really painful and awful.
Yeah. Well, and it's a smaller percentage of men that have azoospermia, which is a very, very small amount, almost
right.
none, you know, and that it's not a blockage and then it's not a genetic issue where even if you had stem cells, I don't know if it would fix it.
It would fix it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably less of like a...
It's a much more small population.
I mean, and just
people.
In general, as we've always talked, and you know how passionate I am about this, men are just not... pulled into the fertility conversation at all, even in just like, hey, let's change your diet. So I can't imagine right. they would go to extremes like that.
Right, but, exactly.
maybe one day having a husband that has very little sperm, it would have been cool. But yeah, they're like, yeah, it's just crazy. Speaking of that, I like to ask this question and we'll be like wrapping up soon. If, you know, we talk a lot about on this podcast sort of pieces of the system that are broken and how we would want to see them be different. And, you know, we're doing the best we can to show up and be different versions of how we imagine the world being. But if you could kind of wave a magic wand, or if there were a few things that you, if the world could kind of actually change how you wanted it in the fertility space, what would some of those be?
You know, one we've talked about already, which is I want couples to feel like they've got options and that they're not pushed to do IVF for everything. I think that's just a big issue. And tied to that, I think there's a huge misunderstanding in terms of the success rates for IVF. It's an unspoken thing. It's not like anyone's going out and misrepresenting IVF on the IVF clinic side of things. They're not. I don't see that. But I think because of the way we talk about IVF, oh, you've got a fertility issue. Oh, just do IVF. The misunderstanding is that IVF is 100% successful. Oh, I just need one cycle. They'll get some eggs, create some embryos, and you know, I'll be pregnant in no time. And that is completely not true at all. And we would have thought that with the improvement in technology and protocols and how we handle patients, that we'd see those success rates increase. And we have seen improvements in all of those areas, but I don't think that that's equated to like this huge jump in success rates. So I think that misunderstanding is something I'd love to see change as well, and having couples not rushing in. I'd really love to just see couples be more proactive in their fertility and their healthcare just much sooner, right? Like, to me, this is a conversation that should kind of happen. I don't want to say when you're dating somebody to scare them off, but certainly when, you know, after proposal, like, would you like to marry me? Yes. Okay. Do you want kids? Let's start talking about how we take care of ourselves, because the conversation happens so late and in some circumstances, they don't even realize that the partner that they chose to spend their life with didn't even want to have kids.
Which blows my mind. Right. But it does happen. It's so true.
Right. So like, I just wish these conversations would happen so much earlier and that we would be more proactive. It'd be so much easier for couples and so much easier for us as healthcare providers without that stress and pressure to like, oh, this has to happen now, because if I can't get them to get results now they're 6 months down the line and they're going to want to do IVF and, you know, it's just a harder thing. So I wish that would be a much earlier process, because we tend to have couples who have tried for years and then come to see us, tried for years, tried IVF multiple times, had failures. Now they're burnt out by the time they come to us, right? Like, for me to ask them to give me more time is hard, because in their mind, they've already spent a lot of time. So those would be the things that I would like to see, and you know, certainly have a little bit more collaboration with IVF clinics who were open to supporting patients a little bit more, as opposed to just doing IVF. But I don't think that part will change very much.
Ugh, I know, it's the saddest part. My journey going through IVF, I was shocked, because they care about fertility success rates, because
it
makes their clinic look good. You know, they get more patients. It is in their best interest to help the people in front of them with more alternative root cause, natural medicine stuff, it blows my mind that they're not only not open to it, most of them, they're like against it. I mean, right. I remember I went to one sperm doctor and I just wanted to know what he would say because I've read all the literature on sperm health. Like, and I asked him, I was like, is there anything we can do? You know, I knew because I was a doctor. I was like, is there anything we can do to improve his sperm health? He's like, no. He's like, supplements are a waste of money. Maybe you could take a Centrum vitamin. And I literally cringe. I was like, I would tell my patient to take no supplement versus a Centrum vitamin. I'm like, right. You're actually doing worse for your health by doing that. And I was just shocked because I'm like, you could be helping these couples. And I mean, I didn't sit him down and tell him that, but it made me really sad, and I want to, because just reading a little bit of your own literature would show that that's not true, and it just makes me sad. So there's so much room for improvement.
And like a cultural shift where people are, you know, it's so well known that if you're going to train for a marathon, you have to be doing months and months and months of training. And historically, and in ancient cultures, and I know I always bring this up and bring this into the conversations on this podcast because I love anthropology, in the successful ancient cultures, there was a preconception period for the new couple, and people were always very, you know, resource driven to give them the very best of the food or the milk that was from the cows that drink, or, you know, were eating the fresh grasses in the spring, or like drinking blood, or, you know, however their culture was, the organ meats, the things that they knew had correlations to successful fertility, because they're building a new community. They value that new community member. They need a strong baby to be born. They need the mom to be healthy. There were so many things where in our system, it's sort of just, it's like I see it being like a porous stone or something instead of being filled in and really integritous. It's like we have some of that structure, but then there's a lot that we've just sort of stopped caring about because it's driven by money and it's hard to care so much about every patient. And I understand that. So it's really like, we need to take this into our own responsibility. Know that the system is there. Know the system's not perfect. There's a lot that we can do ahead of time. But like you said, it would be so cool if people had, even if they knew what that word meant while they were dating. Preconception. Oh, what is preconception? Okay. Like, we were just at a wedding this weekend, and one of my friends who's getting ready to get married, her husband in the morning time was like knocking out these supplements on the counter. And I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, these are my sperm things. I listened to your podcast. And he's like, we're getting ready. And it made us so happy. We were like, yes, you're doing it. And he's like so excited. And he's so invested in their conception of this child that's coming up. And, you know, it's still like 6 months out at this point, but he's ready and he's engaged. And I just think that's so cool. It's part of this conscious conception. And, you know, we're really trying, all three of us are really trying to get that out there, but it does feel like it's something that we still need to permeate. In addition to that, there's Jacqueline Chassie, right? We all know Dr. Jacqueline Chassie, naturopathic doctor. She started working with an IVF clinic, which I just love this little anecdote. She created a weight loss program where she went out and she reached out to all the reproductive endocrinologists in her little town. She said, hey, listen, if you send your people to me and I can get them to do this program for, let's just say it was 12 weeks, I don't know, then I'll send them back to you and we'll see what the success rates are. And the success rates for just that one element of it, you know, it's not going to be every single person has a weight problem, but we do know that obesity is a huge factor in infertility. So she was fixing just that one angle, that one cog in the wheel of the potential reasons why this might not work. And the success rates of the IVF clinics was just like shooting through the roof. So then they were very incentivized to work with her, to send their patients to her first so that their numbers looked good. So there is ways we can like get in there and help things, you know, but it's like, we just need to work together and bridge that gap a little bit more. The junction between natural and conventional, or like, you know, well-rounded TCM or integrative medicine, it is happening. It's coming closer and closer together. I can't wait for it to merge.
I would love that as well. I think the consciousness from the couple needs to be about generations of your family line.
Yeah.
You know, if they are thinking about the decisions they make today are going to impact their great grandchildren, I would hope to think that they will be more invested with the decisions they make. And I don't say that as, you know, theory. This is fact. We know this, right? We know that our genetic makeup will be passed on for generations. And that's, you know, when you're talking about traditional cultures, like, that's what they knew. And that's how they thought. So if we can take some of that into our decisions that we make, and, you know, not be feeding our kids, all the junk that I see everybody giving them, and so forth. And we're going to be just creating better, healthier humans down the line for generations. And I really think that's how we need to approach things. And hopefully that's the key that starts to get some of these couples to think more broadly, because when you have children, as you probably know, is when you see everybody saying like, oh, now I got to buy organic food and I want to make sure I give them the best that I can. That should have started well before. Yeah. And so just think about that concept in that way. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much. And where can people find you and get connected with you?
My website's always easy, marksklar.com. But on social media, my favorite resource for everybody is my YouTube channel, Fertility TV. There's hundreds and hundreds of videos that everybody can check out and learn a little bit more. And then, you know, I'm on the other platforms as well, if they want to find me there. But cool. I think the most useful stuff would be from YouTube.
Yeah, no, you have amazing videos. Definitely check them out. Fertility TV, that's such a good name. You did so good with that. That's like, I'm just like, yeah, so catchy and great. Well, thank you, Dr. Mark, for being on. And I'm sure listeners are going to love this episode. And until next time, have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.